This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. As the Derek Chauvin trial nears an end in Minneapolis and the death of George Floyd, the Biden administration is privately weighing how to handle the upcoming verdict. We get more from AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
The White House is preparing for the possibility of unrest if Chauvin's found not guilty.
We're in touch with states, with governors, with mayors.
Spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the goal is to ensure there's space for peaceful protest. The administration's considering whether President Biden should address the nation after a verdict. The aftermath will be a key test for him, since he's both pledged to fight racism in policing and cast himself as a police ally. Psaki would not say whether a not guilty verdict would disappoint the president. Sagar Magani, Washington.
During a Monday news briefing, the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said the world can bring the global COVID-19 pandemic under control in the coming months, provided it distributes the necessary resources fairly. However, he also expressed concern over the alarming rate of which COVID-19 is spreading in those aged 25 to 59 worldwide, possibly due to much more contagious variants. Britain's health minister, Matt Hancock, says India is being added to its travel red list after detecting 103 cases of a coronavirus variant first identified in the country. UK and Irish residents and British citizens who've been in India in the past 10 days before their arrival will need to complete hotel quarantine for 10 days from the time of arrival. The rules come into force at Friday, 4 a.m. local time, according to Hancock. India on Monday registered nearly 274,000 new daily infections and more than 1,600 deaths. This is VOA News. The U.S. Supreme Court appears ready to prevent thousands of people living in the U.S. for humanitarian reasons from applying to become permanent residents. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn with details.
The justices seem favorable to arguments made by the Biden administration that federal immigration law prohibits people who entered the country illegally and now have temporary protected status from seeking green cards to remain permanently. That TPS designation protects from deportation people who came from countries ravaged by war or disaster and allows them to work in the U.S. Immigrant groups contend federal law is more forgiving toward the 400,000 TPS recipients than toward others. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Monday said the U.S. is falling behind China, the largest producer and exporter of solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, and electric vehicles. Speaking from Annapolis, Maryland, overlooking the Chesapeake Bay, Blinken said that if we don't catch up, America will miss the chance to shape the world's climate future in a way that reflects the interests and values will lose out on countless jobs for the American people. Blinken was speaking as the Biden administration is preparing to host a virtual global leader climate summit Thursday and Friday of this week. President Joe Biden is expected to present a non-binding but symbolic goal for reducing greenhouse gas emissions that will affect climate change efforts in the U.S. and the world. Walter Mondale, the U.S. vice president under former President Jimmy Carter between the years 1977 and 1981, died Monday. He was 93. The death of the former senator, ambassador, and Minnesota attorney general was announced in a statement from his family. No cause was cited. Mondale followed a trailblazed by his political mentor, Hubert Humphrey, from Minnesota politics to the U.S. Senate and the vice presidency serving under Jimmy Carter from 1977 to 1981. In a statement, Carter said that he considered Mondale the best vice president in our country's history. And again, just recapping some of our top stories, the Derek Chauvin trial is nearing an end and the death of George Floyd. And now the Biden administration is weighing how to handle the upcoming verdict in case he is acquitted. And also during a Monday news briefing, the head of the World Health Organization said that the world can bring the global COVID-19 pandemic under control in the coming months, provided it distributes the necessary resources and vaccines fairly. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There are reports Somalia's president has agreed to African Union intervention.
Unless the international community is very serious and take these measures, I think nothing will change and the country will go down into a renewed conflict, civil conflict.
Egypt's transport minister says sabotage was behind a third rail accident in less than a month. Uganda's army and the media face off on a soccer field to improve strained relations. There are calls for the resignation or firing of Nigeria's communications and digital economy minister. And Africa made gains in the 2021 Media Freedom Index.
While there were negative trends, in particular the threat of persecution or actual prosecution of journalists, we did see some encouraging notes from Africa.
However, an exiled Burundian journalist says the condition of the Burundian media has not changed. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There are reports that Somalia's President Mohamed Farmajo has agreed to African Union intervention in facilitating dialogue for settling the electoral dispute in his country. President Farmajo met Monday in Kinshasa with President Felix Tshisekedi of the Democratic Republic of Congo and African Union chairman. But late reports said President Farmajo conditioned his acceptance on Somalia maintaining its sovereignty. President Farmajo, whose term ended February 2021, is refusing to step down or facilitate the holding of free and fair elections. This comes after Somalia's House of Representatives voted last Monday to extend President Farmajo's term. Abdulrazak Omar Mohamed is Somalia's member of parliament and former security minister. He says Al-Shabaab is capitalizing on the security vacuum in Somalia.
In terms of the security, I think because of the political instability also, we also have security instability. Al-Shabaab is more emboldened now because they know they can take advantage and capitalize the political stalemate in the country. So Al-Shabaab has been very active. 2 days ago, they have killed about 19 civilians on the road between Balad and Johar. And they continue to do the BDIED on the road. So the security situation in the country is escalating. In addition to that, there are political instability in the country where the president whose mandate has expired continues to stay in power. The opposition is vying to form a barrier government. The chief of the police of the Banad region has been sacked because he stood by with the opposition by saying that the term extension is illegitimate. So all this, when we look, the security situation in the country is not getting better. It's actually getting worse each passing day.
As you know, the parliament voted to extend the president's term. How true are these reports that the opposition may be planning a parallel government? I'm sure you probably saw a piece done by the International Crisis Group. The International Crisis Group is calling on the international community to do more in resolving this current standoff in Somalia, perhaps suggesting the resumption of talks, perhaps those talks led by the African Union Political Affairs and Peace and Security. What do you make of this suggestion of resuming talks in Somalia?
The only two options that are left for the current president is either to go back to the negotiating table and continue the discussions on the electoral process with the opposition. However, the international community has also called for the parties to go to the table as well. They have called also the term extension of the president and the parliament illegitimate. And they have made clear that they will take measures, including individual sanctions, against some of the major players, particularly the Speaker of the House, the Deputy Speakers of the House, who have been the ones that led the process of the extension. So there will be some sanctions, and unless the international community is very serious and take these measures, I think nothing will change and the country will go down into a renewed conflict, a clan conflict. And that is what the International Crisis Group are warning against.
It's always very nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James.
Abdi Razak Omar Mohammed is a Somali Member of Parliament and former Security Minister. He was speaking with us from the Somali capital, Mogadishu. Reporters Without Borders, also known as RSF, has released its 2021 World Press Freedom Index. Anna Nelson, Executive Director of RSF USA, says most of the biggest rises in media freedom were found in Africa.
The 2021 RSF World Press Freedom Index, I think, demonstrated that COVID in particular has made journalism in Africa more difficult than ever, more vulnerable than ever. We saw reporters being attacked and arrested, their incomes decreasing, and the media in general being undermined by disinformation and draconian laws. And the coronavirus really compounded the difficulties that journalists already face, in particular in sub-Saharan Africa.
So then you mentioned that there were some big rises in Africa, despite what you're saying, that there were some countries that did very well.
It is encouraging that Africa actually saw the biggest gains in terms of press freedom. So while there were negative trends, and in particular the threat of persecution or prosecution or actual prosecution of journalists, often on trumped up charges that had nothing to do with their jobs, we did see some encouraging notes from Africa. Specifically, Burundi rose by 13 spots to 147th. Out of 180 countries, it's not ideal, but it was progress. Sierra Leone also was up 10 places to 75th, and Mali came in at 99th position, and that's up 9 spots than they were at in 2020. It's important to, I think, note that kind of significant improvement and the reasons for it. For example, in Burundi, journalists with an independent media there were released. There were 4 journalists that had been held. In Sierra Leone, there was the repeal of a law criminalizing press offenses. And in Mali, there was a general fall in the number of abuses overall.
Who are the countries, or what are the countries in Africa that did poorly?
One of the trends I think that we see across the continent is the arrest and detention of journalists. That was also the case in North Africa, where we saw harassment of journalists and the media, especially in 3 countries, Morocco, Algeria, and Libya, being one of the reasons that those countries remained in the red or black zones, as we delineate them. So either being ranked as bad or very bad in terms of people's access to information and journalists' ability to do their jobs.
I know you mentioned Tanzania, but did you look also at what's happening, press-government relationship in Uganda, say, for example?
It has to be said that journalism is still very dangerous in Africa, and that's especially true when journalists are covering elections or social unrest. In Uganda, which comes in at 125th spot this year, the re-election of the country's president, who's been in power for the past 35 years, was accompanied by a big surge in abuses against journalists. And that can be said as well of Republic of Congo, which is at 118th position, where we saw journalists arbitrarily held there as an example of one of the abuses. In Nigeria, which is down 5 spots at 120th place, is now considered one of the most dangerous countries in West Africa for journalists. Since 2019, we've seen 3 Nigerian journalists killed with complete impunity while covering street demonstrations. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out that the country that is at the very, very bottom of this year's index, 180th out of 180 countries, is Eritrea. And, there has been no response over the fate of 11 journalists who have been detained for 2 decades.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Anna Nelson is Executive Director of Report. Reporters Without Borders, USA. One of the African countries that improved its scores in this year's Reporters Without Borders Media Freedom Index is Burundi. For example, RSF, or Reporters Without Borders, says Burundi went up 13 points to 147th in the world. The group cites Burundi's release of four journalists with the independent Burundia Iwachu. But Innocent Muhozi, director of the Exile TV Renaissance, says while it was good news to have released the four journalists, the media condition in Burundi has not changed.
No one can consider that there is any improvement in the freedom of press in Burundi, because even those three medias that have been attacked, destroyed by the police since 2015, that now are working in exile from Rwanda, the Burundian government have put pressure on the Rwanda government to close them. Since 24 March, we cannot any longer work from Kigali because of the pressure coming from Bujumbura. So there is no reason to pretend that there is improvement in a way or another, except the fact that those journalists have been released, yes, but they have been in prison while they were just doing their job. So it's a kind of hostages taken by the government at the moment where they release them, at the moment when they were starting negotiations with the European Union, expecting the European Union to reopen cooperation, financial cooperation with the government of Bujumbura. So it's not an improvement. Yes, it's good news to release them, but the situation stays exactly the same as it was before.
Innocent Muhozi is the exile director of TV Renaissance in Burundi. You are speaking with us from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 20th. Relations between the Ugandan People's Defense Forces and the media have been strained in recent months after several journalists were beaten by armed troops while trying to cover a demonstration. In hopes of improving matters, top army officers played two friendly soccer matches with members of the media. Halima Athumani has the final scores and impressions on whether the games may help army media relations going forward.
This was no ordinary match. Guns and boots filled the Philip Omondi football grounds. Most of the spectators were dressed in army fatigues. The no-nonsense military police, feared by both the public and media, cheered loudly as the match between military generals and the heads of several media outlets kicked off. The army generals, decked out in white and blue shirts, were led by the Chief of Defense Forces, General David Muhozi. The media team was dressed in neon green and gray and led by owners of media houses, Nation Media, the New Vision Group, and several others. General Muhozi says the march was meant to consolidate and strengthen the relationship with the media, given what he called the various highs and lows in their interactions.
No. We are not apologizing for anything. We are saying that we are partners. The other day you scratched me, I scratched you back. But bottom line, we are partners. We are in this together. We can't avoid each other. We are in each other's faces every day. So what better way to strengthen our partnership than through such light moments?
The first match between media managers and army generals ended 3-1 in favor of the media. A second match between field reporters and a team of captains, colonels and lieutenants ended with the media side winning again 3-0. The media may have been the better team Friday, but previously have been mercilessly beaten with batons and sticks by the same army. The last encounter was in February when several journalists were beaten as they covered a march by the National Unity Platform to deliver a petition to the UN Human Rights Office in Kampala. The party was protesting arrests, abuses and detention of their party members. Robert Simpala, the national coordinator of the Human Rights Network for Journalists, says Friday's marches were a good starting point for better relations.
They've been beating us and we're running away. They beat today, we run away again. And we're running to nowhere. So we thought we would have a convergence point to talk these issues out, to build trust, and that must be mutual trust, and to lay a foundation upon which we can relate.
Photojournalist Abubakar Woa was among those who walked out of a security press conference on December 28th after the army declined to apologize for beatings of journalists. He spoke about the football match.
It's a step that we are taking. We are not saying that all is going to be well. But we are hopeful that after this, at least we'll have built some relationship. At least we'll have something in common that unites us.
It is yet to be seen if the cheers, handshakes, and unity displayed on the football ground will translate into safe and non-violent days ahead, especially for the media, when the same boots hit the ground again. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Concern Nigeria, a political pressure group, and Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, are calling for the resignation or firing of Communications and Digital Economy Minister Issa Pantami. Citing reports of Pantami's past extreme religious views, the groups are demanding the investigation of the minister by the country's secret service, the Department of State Services. Their demands come after local media reports show Mr. Pantami's past statements, including support for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. In reaction to the reports, the minister renounced his statements, attributing them to age, immaturity, and limited knowledge. Deji Adeyanju, convener of Concerned Nigeria, tells viewers Peter Clotty that it is unacceptable for the minister to continue to cling to his cabinet position, given his past support for terrorist groups.
Our argument is that sympathizers of terrorist groups, you know, and terrorists generally, they never repent. You know, they are just looking for opportunities to get close to power so that they can strike harder. And a multi-religious, multi-ethnic nation like Nigeria, you know, cannot afford such people being so very close to government. And considering Mr. Pantani's close relationship with the president, that we believe that in the best interest of the country, that, you know, he be relieved of his duties as the Minister of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. Again, we also see this as an indictment, which is one of the reasons why we have just written to the Director General of the State Security Service, that's the Nigerian Secret Police. We see this as a huge indictment on the security agencies in the country who cleared Mr. Pantami to be made the Minister of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. How many more Pantamis do we have in government?
But Deji, some people are suggesting that if he has renounced his past radical views, attributing it to immaturity, age, and lack of knowledge, then he should be free just like any Nigerian who is qualified to hold a position as a cabinet minister. What do you say to that?
The natural thing for Mr. Pantami to really show, you know, remorse will have been to honorable resign. This is an international embarrassment on not just the government, but on our country as a whole. You know, that somebody who extolled the virtues of Osama bin Laden, who described Osama bin Laden as a hero, who described Osama bin Laden as a better Muslim than him, now coming to say that he has recanted, you know, that cannot serve. You know, actions should have consequences. You know, people will get away with it. You know, Mr. Pantami should be made to realize that he, those things he did and those things he said, they have consequences.
Some people are saying that Pantami's religious backers are influential and making it unlikely to be sacked. And due to his close relationship with President Buhari, he's not going to be sacked. Yeah. Is that the general idea in Nigeria?
Yeah, I believe that Pantami will not be sacked personally because of his closeness to the president and because of religious grounds. President Buhari should stop gravitating towards men like this because it doesn't really affect his government or his image. It affects the image of Nigeria globally.
Some civil society groups in Nigeria, I understand, are calling on the international community to pressure the government in Abuja, by extension, impose sanctions if this minister is not sacked. Others are also saying that putting pressure or calling international pressure basically is undermining Nigeria's sovereignty because this is an internal problem that needs to be handled internally. What is your group's stance on that?
Our conclusion is clear that it is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious country, and as such, we must always strive to protect each other's interests. It is in the best interest of people who see themselves as wonderful Muslims to ensure that when views like these are aired, that immediately things like these are done, they should do the right thing.
Deji Adeyanju is convener of Concerned Nigeria. You are speaking with viewers Peter Clotting.
Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi says that he is setting up a commission to investigate the causes of Sunday's train crash north of Cairo, which killed 11 people and wounded nearly 100. The country's transport minister, seen on video inspecting the rails at the site of the accident, says that someone sabotaged the track by removing a metal rail and replacing it with a piece of wood. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Egyptian Transport Minister Kamel al-Wazir was seen on amateur video inspecting the track where the latest train accident on the country's railroad network took place Sunday. He appears to uncover a piece of wood that he says someone used to replace a metal rail to sabotage a passing train. Wazir told Arab media that he has officially stepped down and has no problems with being replaced by someone else who is more competent, but that the basic problem with the rail network is still going to exist. It is the custom in Egypt that ministers resign after serious accidents for which they are deemed responsible. However, many Egyptians who support the government argued on social media that Wazir should remain in place. Egyptian media showed engineers working to replace about 200 meters of damaged track at the site of Sunday's accident. Modern track laying equipment could be seen installing the new rail section. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who retweeted the transport minister's video inspecting the track, has set up an official commission responsible for investigating the causes of the latest train crash, which is the third in under a month. Saeed Sadiq, who teaches political sociology in Cairo, tells VOA that it appears likely that someone intentionally caused the accident.
There was also many photos that showed that the lines in those area where the accidents had taken place were removed and replaced with wood instead of iron railways. And it also suggested that anybody who did it must have knowledge inside the railway system. So that's why the suspicion is filling social media about the latest accident and pointing fingers to the Muslim Brotherhood or some foreign sponsors.
Mithat Kamel, a passenger on the derailed train, told VOA that the air-conditioned cars crashed after the train appeared to speed up. He says that someone pulled him out, but that everyone next to him was dead. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A center for sexual assault survivors in Bangui that Doctors Without Borders opened last year is seeing an increase in survivors after violence increased earlier this year. At the Tongolo Center, which is dedicated to survivors of sexual violence, project coordinator Bilgi Ostwork tells Rikish Triak that they are hoping to meet the needs of survivors, but there is more work to be done.
In 2020, we have received 2,024 sexual violence survivors, and that is why we are also trying to reach to as many as people as possible, and that is why also we opened this center.
In recent months, since violence reignited in December, have the numbers gone up again in comparison to what they were maybe when you first opened?
I can say that in January, actually, increasing conflict, we have received more cases than normal. I can say till last week, more than 1,100 sexual violence survivors who arrived to our different clinic in Santo Tongolo and Hôpital Communautaire and Bede Combattant.
The center also is treating and helping male survivors. What unique challenges do male survivors face in regards to stigmatization and, you know, willingness to, I think, talk about the issue?
Generally, I can say that sexual violence is a subject stigmatized, and even for men, it's more, I can say. So it's not very easy for them to come to the clinic to say that I've been raped. So we are trying to have a training our staff to be able to good care for the people, and we are trying to do sensitization activities in the community, saying that it can arrive to anybody. It is not important which sex, which age. It can arrive to everybody, and everybody is welcome in our centers.
That was Doctors Without Borders project coordinator Bilgi Ostwork. He was speaking to Rikish Triak from Bangui, Central African Republic. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Button in Washington saying, have a good day.